Tiling, also I'll refer you to some more revenue-raising mechanisms that are mentioned in that Global Grand Bargain Working Draft. But lastly, just to link it to the upcoming Bali meeting, the big opportunity I think there is for us to include these issues in some way in that Bali mandate to address the economic institutions, the patent regime, the inability of countries to be able to use trade policy to source clean energy from where they want to and how they want it produced, and to be able to set their standards and so on. So we want to see in a Bali mandate, these things won't be resolved in Bali, but we need to get governments to agree that they need to be addressed and it needs to be part of the agenda going forward. So resolving this triple crisis means addressing the global economic institutions. That's how we unite the global justice movement that has been working on the World Bank, WTO, and IMF, together with the climate movement, together with the water protection movement, together with the international indigenous rights movement. That's the only way I see that we can move forward and really address this global triple crisis. Thank you very much.
Victor Minotti, Program Director of the International Forum on Globalization, speaking at the Confronting the Triple Crisis. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll continue with our two final speakers addressing the global grand bargain.
It's my pleasure now to introduce another colleague from the Institute for Policy Studies, Daphne Weisham, who is a fellow, a member of our board. She's also the founder and co-director with Nadia Martinez of our Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at IPS. And she is the founder and co-host of Earthbeat Radio. The Sustainable Energy and Economy Network did the path-breaking work that drew the attention to the disproportionate share of greenhouse gas emissions coming from the international financial institutions, particularly the World Bank. Daphne's also a member of the Durban Group for Climate Justice, a senior fellow with the Sierra Club as well. Please welcome Daphne Weisham.
I agree with many of the previous speakers, the points around deep cuts being necessary and substantial revenue being generated quickly. What I want people to think about is who is going to handle the money. And, you know, one of the sort of principle, first principles of investigative reporting that I was taught when I was an intern at the Center for Investigative Reporting is follow the money. And that's what we've been trying to do for about 10 years at the Institute for Policy Studies at the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. And what we found is some pretty frightening stuff. Right now, for example, Halliburton is the number one energy client of the World Bank. Enron rose to global fame and fortune thanks to the World Bank. In fact, they're still alive and well and got a loan from the IDB recently. We all think that Enron collapsed. They've actually got very strong international presence. You know, we're talking about $300 billion a year by 2025. We're talking about $40 to $50 billion a year in terms of international adaptation. My question is, who's going to handle the money? And unfortunately, if we leave things alone as they are going right now, we are in trouble because it will probably be the World Bank. And I like Walden's hope that we will see the World Bank delegitimized as we have seen the IMF. But I'm afraid what we're seeing is the opposite, that they're actually gaining power and specifically gaining power in the climate arena. And I want to start with a story which I think kind of illustrates my problem with the way things are working right now, which I was in India recently. I grew up there, and I went back for a trip, and we visited the coal mining region, and open pit coal mines are taking over just beautiful forested lands, turning them into just a barren wasteland. And where's this coal going? A lot of it's going to aluminum smelters. Where are these aluminum smelters coming from? They're coming from our country, Alcoa, Alucan, Alusuisse, because it's one of the cheapest sources of energy on the planet, and everybody knows that aluminum, they need 24 hours energy supply. They can externalize all their environmental costs on the local community. In fact, we visited one community that was living right next to an Indian smelter called Nalco, and we saw one child with seven fingers and seven toes, and all the women were complaining of all kinds of physical ailments. Now, what's happening with this project? This was actually set in motion by World Bank Finance. A lot of the deregulation of the power sector in ERISA actually accelerated the energy-intensive industries' migration to the region. ERISA is the state in India that we visited. And to make matters worse, they're taking the fly ash that is generated after you burn the coal, and they're turning the fly ash into carbon credits. Now, follow me on this because it's a little, you know, it's so abstract, it's kind of hard to sort of take in. But you take fly ash, you add a little bit of water and some other sand and other materials, you let it dry in the sun, and you have a brick. Okay, now if you make bricks from regular sources like clay, you actually have to fire them in a kiln. So by the World Bank's logic, all of the greenhouse gas emissions that would be emitted if you fired them in a kiln, you can now sell on the open market to turn the fly ash into cinder blocks. We visited the one of the places. We just happened to be driving by a road where we saw them making these fly ash bricks, and of course the workers were completely unprotected. There's all kinds of heavy metals and radioactive materials in the fly ash, and so this is now what's wrong with this picture. There's quite a few things that are wrong with this picture. First of all, of course, is that our development dollars are financing fossil fuels in the global south. In fact, it's actually increasing. The last study, we'd been monitoring it for a number of years, and back when we started monitoring, it was 100 to 1 fossil fuels to renewables. It then went down to about 17 to 1 after we started screaming and shouting about it. And it's now, the latest study that the Bank Information Center produced, they've increased by, I think, about 100% over 1 year in fossil fuels. So I don't have the exact figures, but they're growing. They're not shrinking their investment in fossil fuels, the World Bank. Okay, so that's problem number one. Problem number two is that they're not counting the greenhouse gas emissions in these investments. So we're actually seeing a bank that is not counting all the emissions that will result from the Chad Cameroon pipeline and the Baku Chehan pipeline and the coal-fired power plants that they helped to finance. But they're doing a very good job of calculating all those carbon credits. So it's bad math. It's like looking at your savings account and pretending that your checking account doesn't exist, even though you're writing checks left and right. That's problem number two. So problem number three with this picture that I've just painted of these villagers living next to the aluminum smelters and being thrown off their land for the coal mines and so on is that it's pushing an export-oriented development model. In fact, many of the people in these villages don't even have electricity. They're living right next to the coal mines and the aluminum smelters that are going 24 hours a day, and they have no electricity. They're getting all of the energy-intensive externalized costs, but none of the benefits. The other problem with this is that the Kyoto Protocol actually doesn't regulate this form of energy-intensive industrial migration to countries like India. And as Victor stated, even if it did, the WTO could overrule it. Now, I'm going through a list of problems. I've got about seven here, and then I'm going to talk about what I think are some solutions to deal with these, because I do think there are ways of solving this problem. Another is that, as other speakers have talked about, carbon trading is right now, maybe in some distant future, it will start to finance lots of clean energy. But right now, last I checked, I think wind energy was getting 6%. Large hydro was getting something like 12 or 15% of the financing under the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism. Most of the credits were going to HFC destruction. Now, HFCs are very potent global warming gases. Yes, we want them destroyed, but we're actually creating perverse incentives to create more of them by creating a market for their destruction. And that's the fear. And that's actually what was, I don't know if you all caught that article in the New York Times a while ago that looked at this particular issue, is that we may be unwittingly creating perverse incentives, just like the fly ash. Instead of externalizing the cost of that fly ash on that coal-fired power producer, you're turning it into an asset to sell on the international market. You're basically telling the coal-fired power producer, make even more money burning coal, please, and here's your carbon credit to do it. And finally, I want to say that the World Bank is being given a very dangerous leadership role on climate change and on carbon trading. And there are all kinds of conflicts of interest inherent in this role, which radicals from the U.S. Treasury pointed out back in 1997. Yes, the U.S. Treasury said this is a serious conflict of interest. The World Bank cannot simultaneously be one of the largest financiers of fossil fuels, public financiers, and at the same time engage in carbon trading. It's a clear conflict of interest. It encourages you to lower your baseline for energy efficiency guidelines, which of course is what happened. And Treasury said if you just increased your energy efficiency standards, that alone would do more than any carbon trade, because the World Bank sets the standards for all the development banks. It's not just one bank. It sets a standard for the IDB, the EBRD, the ADB, all of these big development banks and export credit agencies, and over 90% of the private finance that looks to the Equator Principle banks. The Equator Principles have signed on to these World Bank guidelines, and they call themselves green. And, of course, the guidelines that the World Bank has developed has no carbon accounting for their fossil fuel investments and so on. So what we have is basically, unfortunately, in the case of the World Bank, we've got we're empowering the very institutions that have a very bad track record in terms of following through on the commitments that they have claimed to be making ever since the 1992 Earth Summit, where they were given a critical role in trying to marshal the international finance to deal with the climate crisis. We have a flyer out front and a report that I encourage you all to read, and I'm just going to give you a nutshell summary of it. But basically what we have with the Glen Eagles Clean Energy Investment Framework, which for those of you who don't know what that was, that happened in 2005. Bush was trying to make nice to Tony Blair, and he said, okay, we'll go along with this Clean Energy Investment Framework. We'll give the World Bank the authority to develop an entire investment framework for the entire world, not just the developing countries, on what we should do around climate change. Well, this was when Wolfowitz was the president, and of course he began to delete all references to the words climate change from this document, which thankfully that got out in the press. What didn't get out in the press is, at least, I mean, we tried, but everybody was not particularly interested, was that this document, in its first draft stages, began at 450 parts per million. And went up to 1,000 parts per million CO2 equivalent. Okay, so we've been hearing about, you know, how we got to keep below 450 and the world's going to, you know, go into serious meltdown after that. They didn't even consider anything below 450. That's where they started. Okay, so they're on a business as usual trajectory. And business as usual on steroids is what I would call it. And they've basically laid out an agenda that includes nukes, so-called clean coal, lots of large hydro, lots of carbon trading, and very little in the way of renewable energy. Now, this coming at a time when China just said they want to spend $100 billion on renewable energy. China single-handedly is announced that a few days ago. Now, of course, a lot of it's large hydro and biofuels, but still, $100 billion for clean energy is not chump change coming out of one country. And yet the World Bank can't marshal, you know, $1 billion for clean energy, but they've got all kinds of plans for pushing this dirty stuff. Well, okay, so those are all the problems. That's the way I see the World Bank consolidating its power. It's becoming a big carbon trader. It's now got the prototype carbon fund, the biocarbon fund, the community development carbon fund. They're trying to get in to push avoided deforestation as a big part of the Kyoto Protocol. They are getting ahead of the UN process and saying that they're learning by doing, and essentially always getting their way. Whatever they propose ends up happening. Solutions, here we go. I loved Wolfgang Sachs' statement that we've got to start with ecological disarmament, so I'm going to use that from now on. That's got to be our first, in other words, live within our ecological limits domestically. Clearly, we've got to get our development dollars out of fossil fuels, full stop, no brainer. That's got to stop. And we've got some legislation moving on Capitol Hill. The Hinchey bill is working on trying to end what's been called oil aid, but we need to do the same for coal. We need to count greenhouse gas emissions accurately, and one of the big ideas that I'm trying to push is this idea of a carbon debit mechanism. If you have carbon credits, okay, then let's charge a carbon debit to the same institutions that are claiming carbon credits. So for the Chad Cameron pipeline, all that oil flowing through the pipeline, the World Bank gets to count as a debit before it counts any credits and profits off of the credits. Right now they won't tell us, but they're making somewhere between 5 and 10% on all of these transactions. So that $1 billion project of HFC destruction in China, what does that work out to? $100 million from one project. We need to, and this is probably going to be controversial, but I think we need to get at the export-oriented model of development that we all agree is very energy-intensive, and to get at this migration of energy-intensive industries to countries like India. We need some sort of a green fee at the border with the revenue reinvested in developing countries, in clean energy, in sustainable land use, and match that with some sort of a carbon tax domestically so that we could at least be immune to a WTO challenge until we get them straightened out. Quickly, we need to create an international renewable energy agency, reject the Glen Eagles framework, create a clean energy bank that is completely independent of the World Bank, has nothing to do with the World Bank, with revenue coming from a variety of sources that have been suggested, including possibly a Tobin tax. And we need to, I think we can get to a place where we can globalize a carbon and nuclear-free future. Arjun Makajani, I encourage you to come and listen to his speech. I think is it tomorrow? He talked about how to do it domestically by 2050, and I'm trying to get him to think internationally. So I'll leave it at that, and thank you for your attention.
We'll start first with Dave Badker, a very dynamic ecological economist who studied with one of the masters who's been here today, Herman Daly of the University of Maryland. Dave is the founder and executive director of Earth Economics. He's worked for Greenpeace International in the past, specializing on trade and international finance, and he also worked for several years with the Philippine Rural Reconstruction Movement, a Philippine nonprofit dedicated to ecologically sound community-based development. He's been spending time recently in the country I mentioned as being on the forefront of some dynamic proposals around oil, and that's Ecuador. Please welcome Dave Badker.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to start. You can start with something you did on the day you were born. Take a deep breath. a nice deep breath and savor it. Just think about that. What's that worth to you, to take that breath? If you had your choice between all your stuff and oxygen, in fact, we'll just throw in all Bill Gates' stuff as well. What would you choose? Oxygen or stuff? Let's raise your hand. How many would choose oxygen? Yeah. How many would choose stuff and go without oxygen? Well, I'll challenge you after this. This is what I do to recalcitrant students. I'll give them $1,000 a minute to hold your breath for 10 minutes, but you'll pass out and you won't win. But anyway, how wouldn't we be better off if oxygen was privatized? If it was actually a business, we'd have 6.5 billion customers out there. Well, actually, we wouldn't be better off. We might have maybe the company would break down that was producing it. We might have a half-hour oxygen blackout. You wouldn't have any more customers after that. We'd sort of be in trouble, wouldn't we? Well, just by your vote for oxygen over stuff, you took a vote that natural capital is more valuable to you than all that built capital and all this other stuff. That's a very important value statement that you made. In addition, these ecosystems that have provided this oxygen provide it sustainably, reliably, abundantly, and our climate system distributes it equitably. No market could match that. No private system could match that kind of production, that kind of abundance, that kind of wealth provision. That's natural capital. Our climate is part of that, water, etc. What about community? Take a moment, smile at your neighbor. Just take a moment and smile at whoever is your neighbor. We didn't contribute a dime to the GDP, but I think at least the happiness level went up a tiny bit within the room. And surveys show, and it doesn't matter if you're in the U.S. or anywhere else, these are common human aspirations, desires, that people value their family, their community, their friends more than they value their stuff. Social capital is more important to us collectively. And again, let's review one more thing. Human capital, think about your own heart beating away in there, your liver working, your kidney working, part of your human capital, your education, the fact that you understand English and language, that's your human capital. That also, virtually everyone would vote, is more important than built capital. And yet stuff seems to conquer all. And that is the mistake. I loved Koryanka's statement, many things have no price, but they're valuable. These things we have not placed a price on, and they're more valuable than what we have placed prices on. And this comes to where we must go for our global bargain. We don't have to make a global bargain on oxygen, because it works. Because those ecosystems work. They provide value for free and in perpetuity. John Maynard Keynes was sadly wrong. Well, we don't get a free lunch, he said, but we get something better. We get free oxygen. You don't have to pay for it, in fact. And we get free community. We have our family. We have many things, in fact, that are vastly more valuable. So, we've supersized the consumption of the wealthy in this world, and many people spoke about it, from fish and peak oil, pollution, extinction, forest destruction. We've supersized the wrong things. And by supersizing them, we've lost the valuable things, the things that we agree upon. When it comes to built capital, really, what we need is sufficiency. That gives people the ability, if they have sufficient food, sufficient housing, sufficient resources, sufficient energy, even 100 watts of electricity is what really does the improvement for people's lives. Beyond that, improvement doesn't advance quite as fast. And so it's time to we need to reflect on our common values as we move forward with a new global bargain. And driving all of these problems, from fisheries to oil and pollution and climate, there is a common nexus. There's a common driver. That common driver is in every one of those cases, from Annie's big factories right away to the garbage dumps to climate mess being spewed out into the globe. are economic decisions, bad economic decisions, being made by corporations, by governments, by individuals, which have sacrificed the things we really value for the things that aren't as important. And so solving any one of these problems or all of these problems at the same time requires really the same thing, economic transformation. If we're going to solve the climate problem, we know we need a whole new energy system. It can't be fossil fuel dependent. We need a whole new transportation system. We need a whole new land use system, etc. If we're going to change farming, we need to change land use. We need to change the way we make things, manufacturing. We need to change transportation. We need to change the energy system as well. These things can't be separated. It's impossible. Can we do it? Can we have economic transformation in 10 years, such a short period of time? Well, that's how we got this mess, in fact. It's been building for a great deal of time. But if you look at the 1930s, say, the Depression, there was no measure of GDP, wasn't even a goal, wasn't anything. We didn't have measures of unemployment. We had no measure of inflation. They didn't exist. Macroeconomics didn't exist. The concept that nations should pursue growth unlimited didn't actually exist as an economic concept at that time. Well, then we got a whole new set of economic goals, a new set of measures, new set of policies, new set of institutions. Herbert Hoover in 1930 declared the Depression was over. Why? Because his main economic goal was to keep gold in the United States, to keep sound money. That was part of his solution to the economic crisis of the day. He had the wrong goals. He had the wrong measures, the wrong policies, and the wrong institutions. Well, the New Deal came around. We got a whole new set of policies, etc. And amazingly, between 1932, just in the U.S., between 1932 and 1942, thanks to a double crisis, not quite a triple crisis, transformed almost every sector. The banking sector was completely transformed and regulated. And Roosevelt interestingly knew that the only way to get progress in agriculture was to change banking and investment. The only way to change manufacturing was to change investment and where banking went. And today we're in the same situation. Where investment dollars go, that's where our next economy will be. If our investment dollars go for coal and oil and gas, we're going to have climate catastrophe. There's no mistake about it. And I don't think that we have... One thing, another lesson perhaps from the Depression was we didn't have to fund all those changes based on that industry generating its own funding source. We decided, well, let's tax the rich for it. Let's really move giant, massive amounts of investment, and maybe we don't have to fund it all only through climate mechanisms or others. And I think that's important. So, from the 1930s and the birth of macro, we had microeconomics before, and their only solution for the Depression was, for the economics profession, their advice at that time was, do nothing. Don't act. It's just the business cycle. It'll be solved. Don't we hear the same thing from the economics profession today? Do nothing. Climate really isn't that important. The only reason the Stern report came out a little bit more important is because they had a little longer discount rate. Still, if the damage of climate change would be a little bit further in the future, in that case, they would say, go ahead and fry the planet as well. They used a 1.6% discount rate. So our goal was maximize production of stuff. These other three capitals we can forget about. Now we need, as part of the global new bargain, four new categories of goals. The first has got to be ecological sustainability, scale. Globally and locally and nationally, we must live within our scale. We must live within our boundaries. And that takes a whole set of policies, economic policies that are very important. Second, we have to have equity. When the pie can't grow forever, we must have equity and justice. As soon as you expand people's rights, you get a better economy. When women got to vote, we got a better economy. When slavery was banned, we got a better economy. So the expansion, thank you. So the UN Declaration on Indigenous Peoples is an important step also toward a better global economy because it protects them and their economies, and that helps us all. In fact, if you take note for Indigenous Peoples' economies, What they do is pretty much built capital is something rather disposable. You can churn through your housing, your tools, etc. But natural capital is something that's kept intact. Our rivers, the forests, the real means of production and benefit. So our primary goal, I would like to say, we're not just campaigners on climate or other thing. We should all be campaigners on economic transformation. That should be our uniting principle. We know we must transform this system. There's no mistake about it. But, of course, economic transformation isn't going to happen without political transformation, a lot of change. And so we must unite. The only way to change things and make progress, as has happened in the past, how did we get rid of child labor in the U.S.? Children used to spend 8 to 10 hours in mines, 7 years old, finally banned, etc. Women got the vote. Those things came because different progressive movements actually came together to support each other. The clean government movement in the U.S. knew that they couldn't get anywhere if they didn't get a whole lot more good voters who cared about it. And so they supported the constitutional amendment for women to vote. That's where we need to be. So we need to look around at leaders like President Correa, and I'll just talk about his proposal in Ecuador briefly. So President Correa is basically the first president of an oil-producing nation to say, it's in our best interest to leave the oil in the ground, a billion barrels of oil. And if we value our oxygen, as Atossa said, the Amazon is the lungs of the planet. We only have two sources for oxygen, and it's all from photosynthesis. It's terrestrial plants and plankton, and the Amazon is the largest single terrestrial source. And so it's reasonable that we who are beneficiaries of this tremendous system, let me take one step back. So reflect again. Our commonwealth includes all that natural capital from oxygen, one single good produced by natural capital, which you valued more valuable than all our stuff combined, to our social capital and our individual capital. It's time we realize that our commonwealth vastly outweighs our private wealth. And it's time that our private wealth came back to support the abundance of commonwealth, etc. So in this case, we have an opportunity to assist with that preservation and that agenda. And it comes on a few different things. One, President Correa has also taken the bravery to reject traditional macroeconomics. Astounding, really. The IMF's advice to the president in 2006 was, you should find another billion barrels of oil. And what the IMF, it's a surreal paper that they prepared, and they have what they call the permanent oil consumption sort of plan for the country. How you could have permanent oil consumption is rather amazing. In fact, the IMF themselves say that Ecuador will run out of oil by the year 2031. But they advise that they look for another $1 billion worth of oil, and increase production by 18.2% and deplete the increased supply of oil by the year 2032, increasing by 1 year the oil. So this is what presidents like Correa are up against, and the only way we're going to make real economic transformation is to support progressive governments like President Correa in their effort. And in this case, it means looking creative at new financing institutions to help bridge the gap that they would receive. And so I want to come back to one other point in wrapping up as well. In the 1930s in the United States, it was an impressive period because we had an opportunity to say we want new economic goals. And from that, we have to have new economic measures, new economic policies, new economic institutions. In fact, out of that period, the World Bank, the IMF, and the WTO were born. But today we know that those institutions whose goal is maximizing consumption and production for the wealthiest are obsolete. So they must go away. There's no question. They need to be phased down. And the only way a climate convention, I think, can be successful if it has a powerful lending wing, there's no doubt about it. That lending wing cannot be within the World Bank or that institution. So it's time for us, just as in the New Deal, Social Security was a new idea, a whole new institution. We need to conceive of these new institutions as well, and there's a long list of those proposals and issues. And I think most fundamentally, though, we've got to support new government officials, folks like President Correa, who are coming out with these issues, these ideas. So this is a funding mechanism that we're going to talk about, debt relief, also where the money is going to be spent within Ecuador on social programs and looking for minimum access to energy. If you're going to provide minimum access to energy in Ecuador, you can't possibly do it with oil. You could only do it providing a sustainable and sufficient amount of kilowatts through renewable energy, because you can't possibly ship or get all that oil to the people who need it. And so it's a new sort of paradigm to be developed. So we must support the political mavericks, because in the end, we are facing a tremendous crisis. We're facing a triple crisis, which gives us a choice, perhaps in the future, between fascism and progressivism, between a few continuing to overconsume on this planet and sufficiency for the world's majority, for the world's population, so that we can actually have enough. And just to reflect on, within your own organization, what are the economic policies that we need to achieve sustainable scale, justice and equity, greater efficiency, and not efficiency in producing, saying a farmer in India is inefficient, but destroying that yellow arrow, the golden arrow that Annie Leonard had up there, that's inefficiency. Never before have so many consumed so much and gotten so very little out of it, while so many went without. And finally, the fourth point for economic issues is governance. Our movement has not spent enough time on governance. If we don't change governance and have new governing institutions and have greater free, prior, informed consent is a piece of it. Local communities controlling their resources as much as possible, and global institutions that are accountable are all pieces of that critical solution. So, thank you very much.
That was Dave Bachter, an ecological economist, speaking at Confronting the Triple Crisis Conference, organized by the IFG. You can find more at ifg.org. We'll be returning to more of that material in future shows, but next week we'll be bringing the triple crisis home as we deal with the battle over gas drilling in central New York. I'll conclude the program with another reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. In our reading last week, Susan covered the rise and fall of the Paris Commune and then the Russian Revolution and its betrayal. I read what she wrote without comment, but I will mention that her benevolent description of the Bolsheviks and Lenin is contested by anarchists that participated in the Russian Revolution and who consider Lenin and the Communist Party to have also betrayed the revolution. I don't have time to get into the 150-year ideological disagreement between Marxists and anarchists on the question of state power. I just wanted to acknowledge that there is one. You can learn more about that in terms of the Russian Revolution by Googling Nestor Makhno. That's spelled M-A-H-K-N-O. That's my two cents, which I must put in, especially when giving my voice to someone else's words. Now I'll continue with Susan's words, reading from Chapter 14, Seize the Power, with the next section, Sham Democracy. Nuestros sueños no caben en sus urnas. Our dreams do not fit in your ballot boxes. Capitalism can take different political forms. Electoral systems like the United States and Canada, religious states like Israel and Iran, one-party states like Cuba and China, monarchies like Saudi Arabia and Nepal, and military dictatorships like Myanmar and occupied Haiti. Capitalism can also change forms over time. France's capitalist economy was born in a republic that reverted to a monarchy that was followed by another republic. Germany's economy was just as capitalist under the left-leaning Weimar Republic as it was under Hitler's fascist dictatorship. All capitalist economies have a common feature. They are run by the bosses for the bosses. As long as the few rule the many, there can be no genuine democracy. However, the illusion of democracy is necessary to secure public consent to minority rule. Students are taught that the New England colonies enjoyed direct democracy based on town meetings. However, as the population grew, direct democracy became unmanageable and was replaced with representative democracy. Nevertheless, the democratic principle is preserved because elections are fair and politicians who don't perform can be voted out of office. This sounds reasonable until you consider how it really works. The United States of America has always been ruled by wealthy property owners in order to advance their own interests. According to John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, the goal of the Constitution was to ensure that those who owned the country controlled the country. As a result, quote, the world's greatest democracy is anything but. The president and vice president are not elected by popular vote, but by the Electoral College. In the 2000 election, Al Gore received more votes than George W. Bush. Nevertheless, the Electoral College gave Bush the presidency, and this decision was upheld by the Supreme Court. Supreme Court judges who wield enormous power are not elected. They are appointed by the president, approved by the Senate, and can stay in office for life. Democracy is not served when congressional districts are based on geography instead of on population. Small and overwhelmingly white states are overrepresented, while states with large numbers of blacks and Hispanics are underrepresented. This arrangement has permitted only 3 black senators to be elected between 1877 and 2005. How democratic is it when over 500,000 people living in Washington, D.C. have no voting member of Congress? 4 million American citizens living in Puerto Rico are subject to federal law, but they cannot vote in presidential elections, and they have no voting representative in Congress. Millions of foreign-born people living in the U.S. are denied the right to vote. And nearly 5 million people, including 13% of the black male population, have lost the right to vote because of felony convictions. In order to be readmitted to the Union after the Civil War, Florida was forced to grant blacks the right to vote in 1868. That same year, Florida expanded the number of crimes that would cause convicted persons to lose their right to vote, and these crimes disproportionately targeted black people. Other states also passed black codes. In 7 states, convicted felons lose their voting rights for life. 1 in every 4 black men in those states is permanently ineligible to vote. Amending the Constitution is nearly impossible. The Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA, to provide legal equality for women was first proposed in 1923. It was passed by the House of Representatives in 1971 and by the Senate in 1972. Within a year, more than 30 states had ratified the amendment. Even though most Americans supported the ERA, it fell 3 states short of the 38 required. Today, women living in America still don't have legal equality. Even if all the above problems were fixed, electoral, parliamentary, and congressional systems would still be sham democracies because they separate politics and economics. The electorate is not allowed to vote for a different social system, only for candidates with different views of how to run the capitalist system. The day-to-day operations of capitalism are decided by executives and bureaucrats who are never elected. As a result, no matter who gets into political office, your job doesn't change. No matter how many rotten politicians are replaced, recalled, or impeached, your life doesn't change. No wonder so many people, especially young people, don't vote. As long as the capitalist class controls production, it doesn't matter who gets elected. Whoever controls production controls society. To keep the corporate class in power, the electoral process is managed like a horse race. When the leading horse starts to lose its usefulness to the ruling class, too many lies, too much corruption, too many mistakes, a chorus of reformers clamor to kick him out of the race. The electorate is offered a new horse that is painted as different, better, and more reliable. The same track is used, and the new horse continues to run in the same direction as the old one. When people realize that they have been duped, they are told they must wait for the next race. After several rounds of being seduced into backing one or another savior, only to be betrayed, people lose hope of any real change, to the delight of the ruling class. As long as democracy is equated with elections, you can't complain if you didn't vote, the ruling class can feel secure. Sham democracies can be identified by the huge gap between what people want and what leaders deliver. Most Americans want a government-funded medical system, but politicians refuse to provide it. While public officials harp on terrorism, taxes, and crime, a 2005 poll found that terrorism was a priority for only 9% of Americans. Tax and budget issues were a priority for only 6%, and crime was a priority for only 3%. No wonder most Americans think that Congress does not understand people's needs. Instead of acknowledging the abysmal lack of democracy in America, defenders of the system blame the electorate for the state of the nation. People get the government they deserve. In a real democracy, the people in power are accountable. In a sham democracy, they do pretty much what they want. Domestic spying and torturing prisoners are both against the law. Yet Washington has defended its right to do both. A 2006 investigation by the Boston Globe found that by adding signing statements to legislation, President Bush has quietly claimed the authority to disobey more than 750 laws enacted since he took office, asserting that he has the power to set aside any statute passed by Congress when it conflicts with his interpretation of the Constitution, close quote. The president is clearly not accountable to the American people. By 2005, most Americans believed that President Bush had lied to the public about the need to attack Iraq, and 59% wanted U.S. troops to leave Iraq. Nevertheless, the president remained in office, staying the course he had set out for the Middle East. On more than one occasion, the House of Representatives has backed the president by rejecting a proposal to pull American troops out of Iraq. In a real democracy, war would end as soon as the majority opposed it. In this case, the war would never have started. February 15, 2003, marked the largest anti-war protests the world had ever seen. Millions of people opposed the impending U.S. invasion of Iraq in a chain of demonstrations that circled the globe. Scores of American cities joined protests in Europe, the Middle East, Australia, and Asia. The New York Times reported that, quote, protesters came from a wide range of political spectrum. College students, middle-aged couples, families with small children, older people who had marched for civil rights, and groups representing labor, the environment, and religious, business, and civic organizations, close quote. More than 100 American cities and counties passed anti-war resolutions, including Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Detroit. Unions also passed anti-war resolutions. Sentiment against the war was so strong that the New York Times admitted, quote, there may still be two superpowers on the planet, the United States and world public opinion. In a display of arrogance, President Bush dismissed world opinion, including huge protests by Iraqis who opposed the invasion of their country, by insisting the world would be better off without Saddam Hussein. Whether or not this was true, he had no right to make that decision. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Power and responsibility. Class society severs the link between power and responsibility. Those with the most power take no responsibility, while those with the least power are saddled with the most responsibility. Authorities shirk responsibility with astonishing ease. Who knew that terrorists might hijack commercial airplanes and turn them into missiles? Who knew that the levees in New Orleans would crumble during a flood? Who knew that torture was routine in American prisons? The people in charge are supposed to know these things, and it turns out they did know. It is the height of hypocrisy for them to demand personal responsibility from us when they take no responsibility themselves. In 2005, General Motors announced plans to eliminate 30,000 jobs at its North American plants. Auto workers had no say over GM's business decisions, yet they were the ones who lost their jobs when those decisions failed to produce enough profit. In a genuine democracy, those with power would be held accountable, and no one would be given responsibility without the power to carry it out. Class society violates the basic right to decide what happens to you. Politicians launch wars that other people's children will fight. Employers authorize the use of toxic materials that other people will handle. Public officials decide how to respond to disasters in which other people risk their lives, homes, and loved ones. The people in power are protected from the harmful consequences of their decisions. The mother of a dead American soldier is not even allowed to question the president who launched the war that killed her son. In a real democracy, the responsibility for social problems would be shared, along with the power to solve those problems. As it is now, the people in charge care more about the bottom line than they do about meeting human needs. That is why hospitals serve nutritionally deficient food to sick people. In a real democracy, hospital workers would insist on serving nourishing meals, regardless of cost, and everyone would pitch in to make sure that happened. Capitalism denies individuals the democratic right to decide personal matters. Sexuality, reproductive rights, personal beliefs, and drug taking are all considered fair game for political control. Everyone is entitled to an opinion on such matters. However, people in positions of power have no right to impose their views on others. Violation of the personal right to decide is so taken for granted that ordinary people get caught up in debates about how the state should control individual behavior. The right of the state to dictate such matters is never questioned. Societies based on genuine democracy treat individual behavior as a strictly personal matter. The Paris Commune abolished the morality police. The Russian Revolution struck down legislation regulating personal behavior, including laws against homosexuality, prostitution, and abortion. Divorce was granted on request. At the same time, socially harmful behaviors like hoarding and speculation were not tolerated. This is the opposite of what happens under capitalism, where employers are free to exploit and oppress, while individual behavior is micromanaged. Capitalism cannot allow ordinary people to think that they are capable of making any decisions. Under the guise of paternalism, slave masters oppress slaves, bosses exploit workers, and states dominate entire populations. In apartheid South Africa, the white ruling class insisted that the black majority were not ready to manage their own affairs until the black majority taught them otherwise. Today, Washington claims that it must rule Iraq until Iraqis are ready to rule themselves. Capitalism denies people the right to self-rule, claiming that the majority don't know how to make good decisions. There is an element of truth in this. The majority would not make decisions that are good for the capitalist class. Conflicting class interests are the real reason why ordinary people are denied the right to decide. To stay in power, the ruling class must cultivate the illusion that the majority are part of the decision-making process. Washington insists that our help is necessary to eliminate the tyrants of other lands, even when our government installed them in the first place, and that once we have invaded another country, then we should stay and clean up the mess. No nation should have the right to decide how another nation functions. We would never want some foreign power invading our country, occupying our land, stealing our things, murdering our people, and telling us what to do. We would want to solve our own problems, including settling with our own dictators. Of course, we would accept help, as long as it didn't deprive us of the right to control our own lives. People in the Balkans, Haiti, and the Middle East are no different. A poll conducted by the British Ministry of Defense found that after almost 3 years of foreign occupation, 82% of Iraqis were strongly opposed to the presence of foreign troops, and between 45 and 65% of Iraqis, depending on location, believed that attacks against the British and American troops were justified. When ordinary Americans buy the racist lie that some people are too backward to manage their own affairs, they strengthen the system's ability to deprive them of their own right to decide. America's war on terror has destroyed civil society in Iraq and shredded civil rights at home. If we want self-determination for ourselves, we must support self-determination for others. When we side with our rulers in depriving other people of their rights, then we are sure to lose our own. Just as those with power must be held accountable, those who experience the consequences of any decision must be included in the decision-making. In 2003, the people of Spain gave their ruling class a lesson in direct democracy. The Spanish state backed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, despite the objections of 90% of the Spanish population. When bombs ripped through the Madrid subway system, killing 200, the population exploded in rage. Demonstrators held that their government was responsible for the massacre, chanting, "Your war, our dead." The president was thrown out of office, and Spain pulled out of the war. And I've been reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. We'll continue with this chapter not next week, because our show on gas drilling will take up the entire 2 hours, but the week after. In the meantime, though, you can access this entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. And you can download an MP3 and podcast of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org, where you can also send me an email with questions and comments you'd like me to put to Dr. Rosenthal when I do an interview with her at the conclusion of the reading of the book, or to make any other comments you'd like to make. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.